Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is John Buchanan. John is a Presbyterian minister who was the minister in charge, the pastor, of the Fourth Presbyterian Church on Michigan Avenue in Chicago, but also is the editor and publisher of The Christian Century, an academic and popular journal discussing issues of religion and how it works with the people and organizational structures that today's churches are made of. John Buchanan, With Respect. John, how are you this morning?
I couldn't be better. It's a beautiful day.
Isn't it a beautiful day?
It's just wonderful.
It is. And John, I introduced you as being a person and a pastor in Chicago, but you now have a Michigan connection. What is that?
Well, when we moved to Chicago, John, in 1985, right down in the middle of the city, the minister's house is literally on the corner of Chestnut and Michigan. Could not be a busier corner, and it wasn't quite as busy in 85 as it is now, but we lived there for 10 years before we moved, and Sue and I realized that although we loved the hustle and bustle and energy of the city, we needed a little place to get away from that. So we looked around and assumed we'd want to be on the lake somewhere and found that that was not practical. So we ended up in Three Oaks, and we've just loved it ever since. We've been here since about 1988.
Beautiful. John, where are you from originally?
I was born in Altoona, Pennsylvania, a railroad town, western Pennsylvania, which is a kind of quintessential Rust Belt city, but at that time, a very, very important railroad hub.
Family?
I'm married and have five children, and five married children, and 13 wonderful grandchildren.
It's getting larger and larger.
It is, but I think we're at the end of that line.
Oh, all right, okay. What about your family, your parents, your brothers, sisters?
I have one younger brother, 7 years younger than I. Bill recently retired as county manager in Sedgwick County, Kansas, where Wichita is, mm-hmm. and he's now living in Pittsburgh.
How about parents? What were their backgrounds?
My father was a Pennsylvania Railroad employee, as almost everyone in Altoona. Altoona was a hugely important railroad hub. It got
why?
It got there because in the middle of the 19th century, when freight was really taking off, they needed a place for engines to be added to the trains to get them up over the hump of the Alleghenies, and that's exactly where Altoona is. So the largest railroad yard in the world was in Altoona in the 1920s and 30s and 40s through the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Car shops, engine shops, the K4 steam engine, the kind of classic steam engine, was designed and built in Altoona. So my father was a fireman on the railroad, and before he retired, was an engineer. But mm-hmm. everyone I knew were from blue-collar families working in the train shops, the railroad shops, or on the railroad.
How about your mom?
She was a stay-at-home mom, very bright, very literate, read the New York Times, listened to good music, high school education, but my house was full of books and ideas, and she took good care of my dad and my two brothers in a kind of classic, old-fashioned sense.
Well, now, that's interesting because you've described a working-class family, but one that had inside of the door, the walls of that house, was something more, something different, which was, as you say, New York Times is not your average local daily or weekly.
Right.
So what were you raised with?
Well, she was. They were both very smart. My father went to college 1 year, and I think forever regretted the fact that he flunked out. Went to Juniata College, not far from Altoona. youngest of a large family, had aspired to be something, a doctor, he told me. But economics, the depression, led to dropping out of college. I think he actually flunked out, but and then went to work at any job he could get, and ended up in the railroad as World War II approached. So that's a kind of classic middle class working family in the 1940s and 50s.
Well, you know, the depression. This is everybody who is either from that generation or their children were raised with that horrible, difficult, miserable, bleak time, focusing their attention on life. And again, we all listen. I listened to my parents talk about it. And my mother was a school teacher in Chicago, and they weren't, for a period of time, they weren't paid. They were paid in scrip.
Right.
And but her father made it clear that the three or four or five girls in the family, who were all teachers, had an obligation to give back, and so that if they had to take scrip to teach, that's what they would do.
That's what you did, of course.
So it was and then you talk about the times when they couldn't afford shoes that, you know, to repair their shoes because the leather wore out, so they just put in paper.
Right.
And these were common things, and current generations who don't even remember what Vietnam was about are completely bereft, I think.
Right.
When you come to those kinds of serious issues.
Well, it's in my DNA, and I suspect the DNA of anybody like me who grew up in a working class family where insecurity was a way of life. You just weren't sure. Working for the railroad, for instance, you were subject to periodic layoffs, and those were not only fiscal disasters, but emotional disasters when people were put out of work for a while. Anyhow, the whole depression mentality certainly shaped me and shaped my whole generation.
Absolutely. Now, what did you do about schooling? Where did you go to school initially?
Well, I've got to say that that my parents just relentlessly told me I had to go to college, and I had to get out of Altoona. My father's great fear was that I would fall into the typical pattern of graduating high school and go to work for the railroad. That's what everybody in Altoona did, and he had missed his opportunity. And by golly, his sons were not going to miss that. So I was just pounded with this message day after day. So I went to Franklin Marshall College, got a scholarship. My parents didn't have any money to send me. I got a scholarship, worked three or four jobs, worked in the summer, paid my bills. And they were, I think they were pleased. My brother also went to Waynesburg College, so, and on to Kent State for a master's degree. So we listened to our parents.
This is good. But now, all right, I became a lawyer by default. That is, my dad said, you need something to do for a living.
Right.
So you will do this. And I think I was very resentful of that. Mm-hmm. Even though I was raised in a legal and a teaching community, a family, boy, I was by God, not going to be a lawyer or a teacher.
Right.
Well, lo and behold, that's exactly eventually what happened to me.
Right.
However, I think that there is an interesting phenomenon when parents are driving their children. We've seen this for, you know, millennia, that some parents really push hard. And I sometimes see kids come out resentful of that, and other times they come out and they say, you know what, it worked out.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, I'm eternally grateful for their commitment to this notion that their sons were going to become all they could become. And that was my dad's mantra, is one, you can be anything you want to be, but you need to become all that you're capable of becoming. You need to push yourself. You need to get more out of yourself than you want to. And that's an important, that was an important learning for me, and I'm grateful for that.
So your drive, part of your drive that has moved you on through life is your dad. How about your mom? What did she provide?
Well, she was, they were both readers. Dad loved history. He also read, they read the Sunday New York Times. That's my image of Sunday around our house, is the New York Times all over the living room. Mother was a reader, a regular client of the local public library, and there were books in our house, shelves of books, and she always had a stack of books beside her table, and she was always reading. In fact, one of my delightful memories is when I was accepted at Franklin and Marshall College, they used to send a reading list to get ready before, and I didn't want anything to do with that. But my mother read the entire reading list. I remember John Steinbeck of Mice and Men or something was on there, and my mother telling me and sitting me down, putting a book in my hand, saying, "Now, read this." And so that was a big reading has been just very central to me, and that's because that's what I grew up watching.
So what did it produce in you when you were going off to college and you've had this drive from your dad and this culture from your mom, actually from both of them, but they each gave you something a little bit complementary.
Right.
What did it do to you as you went off to college?
Well, the atmosphere in our home was one of, they wouldn't have called it this, but it was intellectual curiosity, an openness to ideas, unafraid of questioning conventional ideas, unafraid to step outside the boundaries of what everybody was saying and thinking, and that's a pretty important gift. So I was always a reader. I was in love with ideas. I loved being in college. It was a great eye-opener to me to be around these people who lived a life of scholarship and who were funny and witty and urbane and literate and smart as all get out. And I just loved it. I wasn't much of a student. I never rose to that level during undergraduate, but I did appreciate what I was witnessing.
That's good. I was a baseball player, and I appreciate good baseball players.
Right.
All right. So, you went to college. You graduated, I take it, and went on to what?
Well, I didn't know what to do. I graduated from college in 1959. That's an odd time in history. It's right after all the excitement of Second World War and the Korean War, and it's a little bit before Vietnam. And so it's a quiet time. Tom Brokaw writes about people exactly my age who missed Korea and missed Vietnam because we're right in the middle. So I'm not quite sure what to do. Before and after me, you left college and went into the service. I was in ROTC, Air Force ROTC, for a couple of years and dropped out after 2 years. Many of my fraternity brothers and classmates went on to careers in the Air Force, but I wasn't sure what to do. An advisor of mine, I was a political science major, and an advisor of mine, who I got to know well, his name was Wayne Glick. Dr. Glick said, "Buchanan, you're asking really important, big questions about life. You don't know what to do." I was contemplating going to work or joining the Marine Corps or going to law school. He said, "Why don't you take a year or two out and think and go somewhere?" And I've got a suggestion. He said, "Why don't you apply to the Divinity School of the University of Chicago?" And I said, "What? Divinity School? I don't want to be a minister." He said, "They don't care about that there," which isn't altogether true. He said, "But they will teach you to think. There will be a rigorous atmosphere, and you'll love it." So Sue and I did what people did back in the dark ages. We got married as soon as I graduated and packed everything into a 1957 Ford and went to Chicago. And the rest is sort of history. I got hooked. I had never, ever known that there was this community, this rigorous community of thoughtful scholarship committed to Christian faith. I just never put all that together. So I was quite taken by that. I went to the University of Chicago at a wonderful time when their Divinity School faculty was a kind of a world-class bunch of people, and I thrived. And about halfway through that experience, I decided this is wonderful. This is a good life. And I took a small job, actually to pay my bills as a student pastor, having no idea what I was getting into, and just fell in love with the idea of being a pastor, being able to teach, being able to be in people's lives at the most intimate and critical times, being expected to read and work hard intellectually. It was just a life that really, really appealed to me. In retrospect, John, and I think most of these notions come in retrospect, I would call that my call to ministry. It was an intellectual itch. It was an appeal to whatever in me responded to the job. If you wanted to put that in religious terms, you would say that's the Holy Spirit nudging, pushing, pressing, calling. Mm-hmm. And I say that without hesitation now, although at the time, who knew?
Yeah, who knows?
Right.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to John Buchanan, who is the former, he now retired, pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Right across, as I recall, John, from the Water Tower place, or close to it.
Catty corner from Water Tower, right across the street. We used to say the John Hancock Tower is across the street from us.
Oh, okay. All right. That's fine. All right. And we've been talking with him about his background. We're going to be talking some more about his ideas, his perceptions of where religion has come from and where it's going in the United States. This is John Smetanka. The name of our program is With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Buchanan, the retired pastor, now resident of Chicago and of Three Oaks, Michigan, pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church, a scholar, a person who interested in ideas, and the author of many books, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later. This is John Smetanka. John, when we broke, you were talking about the stimulating atmosphere at the University of Chicago Divinity School and some of the great people that were there. But there's a person that you've mentioned twice that I want to highlight a little bit more. That's Sue. Who the heck is Sue?
Well, Sue is the woman who, in a moment of utter weakness, agreed to marry me. Sue and I are both from Altoona.
How did you meet?
Well, this doesn't happen anymore. We met, John, in junior high school.
Yeah.
She was in seventh grade, and I was in eighth, and she was in the first majorette corps at Keith Junior High School, and she was a cute little blonde, and we dated beginning in junior high school and high school, on and off. You know how these things go.
Yeah.
It waxed and waned, and then during college got serious. So we've been together since 19... Our first date was 1952.
Oh, right, you, right on.
So we've been married 56 years.
Okay. Now, that also is unusual.
Yes.
That's very unusual, and that's great. Now, John, you came to the idea of being a minister, sort of backing into it through the world of the intellect and
right.
Part-time job.
Right.
And you just kind of needed some money, and you got it.
Right.
Where'd you first go?
Well, let me just add that.
Sure.
The other influence that compelled me to ministry was the civil rights movement.
Uh-huh.
That exploded in American culture, you recall, mm-hmm. in the late 50s and early 60s. And I signed up as youth director of the First Presbyterian Church in Chicago on the corner of 64th and Kimbark.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was a nicely integrated church, about half African-American and half white people. But all the kids were African-American kids. And so I was exposed to that as a young man, and then was quite taken by the whole Martin Luther King Southern Christian Leadership organization, and watched that develop and became part of it, participated in it, became committed to it. And what got to me was seeing the church, this is something I'd never seen before, seeing the church as part of this huge cultural upheaval that was going on. Ministers and priests and nuns were leading demonstrations. This was unheard of, deeply distressing and disturbing to my father, by the way, who could mm-hmm. not understand what ministers are doing. I found that incredibly important and inspiring. And so I put together organized religion and, in fact, huge cultural changes, and saw religion making not uncontroversial but important impact by taking a stand, standing with the dispossessed, and that was part of my interest in ministry came from that.
Did you have a participation in the South? Did you go to the South?
You know, I did not go to the South, and it's been one of my eternal regrets. On two occasions, I was called by friends leaving, and this is a lame excuse, but I simply didn't have the money. I had two little kids, two little daughters at that point. You needed $100 for a bus ticket and for your bail when you got arrested, and I didn't have a penny to rub against a penny. So I prayed. I did involve myself in local efforts, mm-hmm. Efforts later on to establish human relations councils in cities where it was.
Well, you know, if you were in Chicago during that period of time in the early 60s, that was a sort of a, I want to say a magical time, but it was an exciting time. You had the civil rights movement, you right. had the Kennedy election, Kennedy-Nixon right. election, and the first, what we now afterwards called Camelot, and the excitement of right. of this new president, and the assassination, and then the turmoil of the mid-60s. All of that was roiling about when you were just watching
right.
and being a part of a church that wanted to become involved. What was it like living it and being a pastor, not just in the area of the civil rights movement, but the whole change of society?
Well, people in the 60s, as you recall, were pretty divided about civil rights. There was some remnants of flat-out racism. My first church was in northern Indiana, and the town where I was the very, very young pastor, the police told me their tradition in that town for years was if there's an African American around after dark, he was asked to leave town, or she was, or hassled, and then mm-hmm. so that was there. One of the formative experiences I had, John, was Andy Young, who was mm-hmm. King's lieutenant and part of wonderful man. Andrew Young came to the University of Chicago Divinity School, and it was a couple day conference, and I drove in from Indiana for this meeting and met him. And he said something which was really important to me. He said, you know, boys, and at that point they were all fellas, mm-hmm. not everybody can get on a bus and go to Selma. And in fact, not everybody should go. What's equally as important is someone to stay in the pulpits of suburban and urban white churches and be the interpreters of what's going on, and put this whole thing in the context of the gospel to which we're committed, so that people slowly, slowly might see this not as a left-wing plot, as it was being called, not mm-hmm. as socialism or communism, but a deeply, profoundly religious impulse to affirm the worth and value of every human being as a really profound part of what we believe. That was an important date for me. So that's kind of what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I advocated from the sidelines. I try to have congregations understand why we're talking about this in the first place, why this is an important issue for Christians. Not everybody was happy with that. Certainly not everybody agreed, but I learned over the years that ministers are in a really unique position, that if you approach difficult topics with respect, people will at least give you a hearing.
Come back to that's an interesting two words you use, which is the title of my program, which is with respect. If you deal with people with respect, one of the things that I grew up in that same period of time, I was involved. I was in law school. I was in the South in the seminary when James Meredith integrated University of Mississippi.
Right.
And I remember seeing the cars, the police cars, mm-hmm. streaming north to go to be a part of whatever was going to happen up there.
Right.
And I remember 3 years living in Gulf Coast, Mississippi, in the bayous of Gulf Coast, Mississippi. I remember watching the relationships between African Americans and white Americans, and it was really interesting. I was also fascinated by the attitudes that people from other parts of the country brought to their time in the South, mm-hmm. when we were down there for 3 years. And I saw people from older and younger than me, as well as my contemporaries, going through this adjustment period. And I remember riding over on a bus to New Orleans, and I was with a fellow from Minnesota. And I remember he had just arrived from the north about a day before. And we were all taking this trip over to New Orleans for, you know, an afternoon or a day of fun, which whatever you can do for 25 cents, which was what we were allowed at the time.
Right.
Okay. So it was it is amazing what you can do. It's actually 50 cents, but it was amazing what you can do. And as we got on the bus to go over, the first thing he said was, "John, how do you deal with it?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "This." And I'm just wondering what the hell he's talking about, because he was so passionate.
Right.
And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, the tension." "What tension?" "The tension." I thought he was talking about the tension, which we had a lot of in the seminary between the old church people and the new church people,
right,
and everything. That was, he said, between the blacks and the whites.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" At any rate, he started rattling on, and I thought to myself, I listened to him, and I thought, you don't understand what's going on here. You really don't. You have a perception that your idea of racism from the north is what's going on down here. It's different. It's different. There is, you can have, for example, in the south in those days, you would have black families living next to white families. You know, they didn't go to the same schools, but they lived next door to each other. They were raised together. And there were differences, but they were not, in those days, they were not as visible that you could pick it up in one day.
Right.
So I said, he said, "Well, you know, all the segregation." I said, "Well, what segregation have you seen?" And he said, "Well, it's everywhere." And obviously he didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And I said, "Well, wait a minute. Bill, you come from Minneapolis, right?" "Yes." "And in Minneapolis, there's segregation." "Oh, no, there's no segregation in Minneapolis." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. Now, you've got people who live in one neighborhood, and they tend to all be black, and the next neighborhood is all white." And I said, "Well, how does that not turn into the schools are, you know, black schools and white schools?" "Yeah, that's right." He said, "Well, how does that turn out to be segregation?" And he said, "Well, that's because they like to live with their own."
Huh.
And I thought, I don't think I believe
no.
I heard this out
no.
of a seminarian.
No.
And I would say the same thing. I had another conversation with people from Texas and another one from people from North Dakota. And we talked about relations between groups. The same words that were being used for African Americans, negative words, in those days, and was decried by the people from Texas or the people from North Dakota, were the same words that they used in North Dakota about the Indians and in Texas about the Hispanics.
Right, right.
And it came to me, and I want to focus on this because it's, you talked about the concept of respect, and it's troubled me ever since I started getting involved in public life and public discourse especially. You have to start, I'm going to put to you in a statement, you have to start with the concept that people have the potentiality for goodness and the potentiality for badness, everybody. And you got to feed the good and downplay the bad. And respect for their humanity is the starting point. And I was struck by the way you said you can discuss this, you can raise this, and you talk to people with respect.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it was a shock. It was a shock to people in the North when Martin Luther King came to Chicago and challenged and said Chicago is the most segregated city in the country. And in many ways, Northern segregation is part of housing patterns, part of it. The Chicago school system is heavily, heavily African-American, Hispanic, white.
To this day?
To this day. So it's deeper and more profound. I do think that it's legitimate to challenge the structures of racism that keep this whole thing in place. And I think that's part of the duty of people who love God and love their country, is to kind of hold the country accountable for for looking carefully at what we do that keeps racism alive and well.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And at the same time, you don't want to... I was always struck by pastors, priests, others who tended to overlook some of those, and right. because they had parishioners who, for example, when the white real estate dealers engaged in blockbusting
right.
on the south
right.
side of Chicago and the west side of Chicago,
right.
that they just kind of overlooked, you know, the anger that was produced. Because I lived on the south side, and my family had to move out because of crime that was on their block, mm-hmm. in their house. They broke in, and we had a single aunt was the last person living in the house. And But I watched and I listened to the bitterness as those groups, those families, had to move out.
Right.
And I thought, how do we get across? How do we mollify this? How do we ease the burden that both sides, black, white, decent people, because they've rubbed up against each other and it's not perfect, life is not perfect. How do we deal with that?
Well, you're asking very basic questions. The theological response to that is we all need to be honest about our own heart and soul and repent and do better than we're inclined to do. I do think when it comes to the blockbusting thing, that it was the job, and the Roman Catholic Diocese of Chicago, God bless them, did challenge that and name it, and then even began to fund community organizations which pushed back and went to individual white homeowners and said, don't sell. Mm-hmm. You're being ripped off by real estate people.
That's right.
Who are going to get less than your... Just stay put. And to some degree, that worked every now and then, but of course not across the board. But
no.
But there's an example of institutional racism that ruins life for a lot
ruined
of people
city.
And ruins the heart
ruined
of a city.
Destroyed. It destroyed the beauty of the neighborhoods, if
right.
they had, and it also destroyed the people on both sides.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It made bitterness rampant.
Right. Absolutely.
And led to some things that happened later on in the later 60s that everybody says, well, where did that come from?
Right.
You know. So we're going to take a break right now.
All
we're
right.
talking to John Buchanan, who is the retired pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago, and the editor and publisher of The Christian Century. We're going to be talking about that and maybe some his thoughts on the future of religion. We're going to be talking about these things after our break. This is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Buchanan, who is the retired pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago, a landmark that towers over the John Hancock Building right across the street. This is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. John, when we broke, we were talking about how a structural problem with our society, which has been in existence since for 400 years, that people have come to America, and how the tectonic plates between the past and prejudices and religion and people, individual people's lives, all rub up against each other and produced conflict or heat or light sometimes. And people had to probe their own souls, and many did, and came up with and became heroes.
Right.
And others didn't quite work out that way. But John, the church that you are a minister in is a church. How would you describe the unique character of the Presbyterian Church?
John, my kids say, don't ask Dad a question like that unless you have a lot of time.
So. All right, John, we can do two or three shows here. But
right. Well, the Presbyterian denomination comes out of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. Martin Luther was in Germany, and a French intellectual, an attorney, by the way, by the name of John Calvin, became enamored of Luther's ideas, thought his way through, and created a way of governing a church based on what we now recognize as elementary democracy. That instead of authority top-down, this church would be run on the basis of authority from the bottom up. People would actually elect their pastors and their religious leaders. And then it wasn't long before Calvin and others, Calvinists said, well, you know, that's a pretty good idea. That's a political idea. The ancient Greeks tried it, and so it's kind of the heart of democracy. Presbyterian Church is not a hierarchical church. Each congregation elects its pastor, elects its own officers. Theologically, we've been middle of the road to progressive down through the ages. We valued, because of Calvin's influence, higher education. Many, perhaps most of the early colleges and universities in the United States were established by Presbyterians. So on and on. We have a world, a global vision of peace and justice, and the church is losing members, as is the case with every denomination, but we're still about 2 million strong and an influential part of the American landscape.
The Presbyterian Church has been an influential part of the American landscape for the life of this country.
Right.
And many of the leaders and intellectual and political and even economic leaders were Presbyterians.
Right. Right.
But as you say, all religions, religions of whatever stripe, seem to be in, if they're the main line, and you call it, we're going to talk about main line in a minute, but the main churches, the traditional churches, are losing members. Others are picking up members, other concepts, the evangelicals and whatnot.
Right.
But let me ask this. Why is it, why do you think that this moving away from the traditional churches that were dominant in the first 150 years of our country, why are they losing members?
Well, that's the $60 million question. I mean, every Protestant, every Christian is asking that same thing, and it's an enormous amount of scholarly investment in trying to nail this thing down. One of the ideas that I think is most compelling is by a woman whose name is eluding me, and I'll pick it up here as I go along. But she proposes that if you take the big picture of the church, starting with the New Testament era, Jesus and the disciples, right up to if this is all one big story, about every 500 years, there's the equivalent of a rummage sale. when old stuff gets hauled out of the attic and sold and gotten rid of, and new stuff begins to happen. So it happens with the rise of the papacy, it happens with the Protestant Reformation, and it's happening. We're on a 500-year cycle right now from the Protestant Reformation. So I like to think that the church is God's project, not ours. Old stuff is being reshaped and reformed, and on the other hand, you've got churches losing members, but there's enormous spiritual ferment. Look at Pope Francis, who has become a rock star, and millions of people are interested in what he's got to say and fascinated by his simple faith, his commitment to people. So I don't despair about the big picture. We're in the middle of a rummage sale. Some of the old traditions, including ones that are very, very dear to me, have to go in order to make room for something new to emerge. Institutional religion does that. It changes every couple of generations, and we're in the middle of a huge change right now. So I don't think the Presbyterian Church is going to disappear. I think all over the country, all over the world, we're trying new forms. The Presbyterian Church, along with every denomination, is organizing worshiping communities, but not making them act like a traditional church, not making them buy a building and hire a pastor and buy life insurance. A whole different ferment is happening, and something new is coming up. I don't know what it's going to look like.
In years ago, I read a book by a Romano Guardini, who is a Catholic philosopher, scholar, religious, that priest, as I recall. And he wrote some very interesting books. At the time that they were written, were on the level of groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. However, one of the books that I found most fascinating and scary at the time is a book called, it's a little pamphlet called The End of the Modern World. And he traces, in the terms that you've been talking, the history of the world essentially into the ancient world, the Middle Ages, and the modern world. Mm-hmm. And each isn't about, he probably expands it to 750 years as opposed to 500, but he basically traces the end of the Second World War as the end of the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
And that from there, his book is to try to tease out what's going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read it, he basically talked about the shattering or the melding away of the institutional churches.
Mm-hmm.
He dealt with the Catholics, but it could be equally applicable to virtually any of the churches, into smaller and smaller communities of faith. And he ended up by defining, predicting that the new religions, the new whatever they were, whichever denomination, were going to be smaller communities held together by charity, by love, and that was their world.
Right.
That would be their world. And it was, he used the phrase, the world of the spirit, that's how the spirit's going to operate. When I read your book, and I thought very highly of your books, I thought, he's doing the same thing. He's talking about the same thing. You traced in one of your books being church and becoming community, and in another one, A New Church for a New World, you talked about this issue that we've been talking about, the institutional churches are changing. I don't remember the neat expression about the rummage sale, but that's a good one.
That's probably not in the book. That happened since I wrote the book.
Okay.
And by the way, her name is Phyllis Tickle.
Okay.
It's a wonderful, unforgettable name, but we need to credit her. She's the rummage sale thinker.
But you talk about essentially the same thing. You talk about the Fourth Presbyterian Church, and I want you to talk about what you did when you got there, because this is a big deal. The Fourth Presbyterian Church is a very important institution in Chicago and has been for years, and it continues to be under your tutelage. I read you telling me, the reader, that I'm doing a Guardini's work. I'm following out Guardini's prediction,
mm-hmm.
i.e., a community joins together at the lowest level and makes a community of religion and faith and whatever, by charity.
Right. Well, John, what I attempted to do at Fourth Church, and by the way, it had a long history of reaching out to its neighbors in different ways, appropriate for each different era. But what I tried to do is to cultivate the notion that the church exists for the world. The church exists for the people around it, not for its own sake. So we're not in survival business. Survival business ultimately is not very interesting, and institutions that just struggle to survive usually aren't very, very compelling.
And they die.
And they die, ultimately. So the vision that I proposed, and I think was largely endorsed by lots and lots of people, is that we're here to make a difference in the life of this city in one way or another. So we open our doors, we open our windows, we let everybody in, and we go out into the world in ways that are helpful, ways that Jesus did, helping people who are sick, people who are poor. Probably the most exciting program, and it was in existence when I got there, but we greatly expanded it, was the tutoring program. You remember Cabrini Green, the Chicago Public Housing Project, just 1 mile west of Fourth Presbyterian Church, and the kind of the worst public housing project in the country. The proof beyond any doubt that that whole sociological experiment failed. So by 1985, Cabrini Green was the site of total family disintegration and dysfunction. Kids were afraid to leave their house to go to school. Parents were mostly single mothers. Anyhow, the tutoring program brought kids from Cabrini Green to the church for an hour, for an evening of tutoring once a week. And we grew that program to 500 kids. And a volunteer tutor would learn about the child, help the child with English and math homework, share a meal, by the way, at the beginning of the experience, and over time develop a kind of personal relationship with the child and then the child's mother or family. And I like to think that we changed a lot of lives in that program. And one of the changes that happened is that the volunteer tutors were about 20% church members, but 80% came from the community. So these are young adults. They're energetic. We think they're selfish. They're really not. They're young bankers and lawyers and doctors and medical students, and they found this program touching something deep inside them. So they volunteered, got to know the kid, and a lot of those people became church members because they saw the church making a difference in the life of the city. Well, we did that educationally. We did it with a health program for homeless people, a food services program, a social service center where homeless people could drop in. We opened the doors to the sanctuary so that homeless people were in and out of the church in the cold weather, sleeping in the church during the day. And that was a picture that I think is just very elegant and eloquent of what the church is about. Here's this glorious Gothic structure, and there are 15 or 20 homeless people on a cold January day finding a place for a sandwich, use of the restroom, by the way, which is an urgent matter for homeless people. That was a church being the church, and I think that's a compelling vision, and it worked. People were drawn to the church because they know when they come through the door, their being there is making a difference in the life of the city.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to John Buchanan, the retired pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago on Michigan Avenue. Its stepchild is the John Hancock Building across the street and the and nearby the Water Tower Place for shopping. Seriously, we've been talking about religion and where it's going and how this ferment in religion in America is taking a different shape. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Buchanan, who is the author of several books, of which two I mentioned earlier, A New Church for a New World and Being Church and Becoming Community, but also is the retired pastor of Fourth Presbyterian Church and is now a partial, sometime resident of Three Oaks. John, when we broke, we were talking about the unique things, maybe they're not unique, maybe these are replicated all over the country, but things that you did at the Fourth Presbyterian Church or was done while you were there, in which there was social action, it was directed towards the poor and the dispossessed and the less gifted, and yet it involved the entire community. And in reading your book, especially the one Being Church and Becoming Community, you talked about how people came in from, as you said earlier, lawyers, doctors, stockbrokers, people who were certainly in the privileged class economically or socially. And they jumped right in and became a part of this community that you created, that was created, whether you did it or contribute to it. So is that still going on?
Absolutely. My successor is a brilliant, exciting young woman, and she's got that church up and running, and it's just as strong as it's ever been. Another dimension, which I'd probably like to mention, is that the church is unapologetically traditional in its approach to worship. So there's like the best organ in the city and a professional choir where the music is elegant and the worship service is traditional Presbyterian. It's thoughtful. It's stately. And, you know, that gets a bad name among many religionists today, that young people don't like that. And I find that's not always exactly true, that when worship and when music and liturgy is done unapologetically and thoughtfully and beautifully, it's compelling. So nobody ever, nobody ever quit Fourth Presbyterian Church because the music was classical music, because it was done so well and presented with such thoughtfulness. So I think part of what's going to happen is that the traditions, Methodism, Lutheranism, Presbyterianism, will continue to live in churches that are able, because of their circumstances, to do that, while the rest of things, everything is kind of in turmoil and new things are happening. These big old battleship churches will, I think, this is my picture, will keep the important theological and ecclesiastical traditions alive while the church reforms itself.
And reform, which is, you're back to the 500 years ago.
Right.
Reformation.
Right.
You know, when you talk about music, I'm not going to interject too many of my personal views on this, because I do not like much of the music that is in my church, and I yearn for the times when we had some of the great American classics or the great European classics. And every year my greatest personal joy is to listen to the whole Messiah, because it's such a stirring blending of music and culture and religion. It's el numero uno in my life.
Right.
However, John, we are coming to a point, and I'm going to trace something. I'm going to put a structure to you. I see that from looking at it from a historical perspective, I see the Christian church going from peace at the very beginning, the little peaceful community of little people together, and they're taking care of each other, and then they kind of grow and they become an annoyance and they're persecuted because they're nonconformists. Then Constantine and the cross in the sky, and they become the dominant cultural, economic, and later political feature for another 500, 600, 700, 800, 1,000 years. Then they come to the Reformation, but also not just the Reformation, but the touching of other religions, such as Islam.
Right.
And it becomes a defensive, there's a defensive phase to all of the religions. Then finally, we get to what I think I detect from your book, and I think is happening, a retreat from cultural domination or dominance. And we're, again, this is coming back to the thought of churches going into local communities much more, local organizations around common interests and themes and groups. But we are also seeing something coming, which is going on right now, which is and should be frightening. And that is the turmoil around the world in religion. In not just you and I talking about various ideas, but rather Christians fighting with each other. That happened for hundreds of years in the Middle Ages. But now it's Islam fighting within their culture,
right,
and with the Christians, and with the Buddhists, and with the Hindus. And all over the place we have this turmoil, which is not just intellectual. It's not just prayer. It is violence.
Right.
What
right.
is going to happen, John?
Well, what gets all the press, of course, is religion, religious extremism, which slips so easily into violence. And that's the shadow side of religion from the very beginning. Every time religionists achieve political dominance or power, bad stuff happens throughout history, no matter who. Mm-hmm. Catholics, Protestants, Muslims, Buddhists, whenever you get your hands on the levers of power, and extremist thinking takes over, so that our truth is the only truth and your truth is not even close to truth, you've got to either change your mind and join me or be eliminated in some way or not. That's how religionists think when they get power. The other side of the picture is that there are many, I think maybe even the majority of Christians, Catholics and Protestants, Muslims, who understand that and who understand that living together in some kind of respectful peace is the only hope for the world in the future. What's going on in the Middle East is just absolutely appalling, as ISIS just this week, you know, beheaded this wonderful archaeological scholar and blowing up churches. And that's a prime example of what happens when extreme religionists get a hold of political power. So I think we need to be skeptical of that. I think the church, the Christian church's job is to take care of the poor, to stand always with those who are on the outside looking in, no matter who they are, to reach out in kindness and generosity to people around, and to be a voice for justice and fairness in the public realm, but not ever to cram our notion down your throat of what is true and right and good. That's when religion goes off the rails.
Well, you know, it's interesting, John, because not only is it religion in the concept that we've been talking about, which is the belief system revolving around whether or not there is a God, how this all fits together, existence fits together. But today they talk about one of the prime architects of the problems in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge. Mm-hmm. When they took power, they were an agrarian, if you will, the reformers of the country, and they wanted to literally took apart the entire structure of society,
right.
Killed millions of people.
Right.
One of the prime persons died recently, and it made me think that it's not just a religion in this which does this, religions who do this. It's movements. It is radical changers, radical and people who see that change has to be root change. Mm-hmm. And if what you just described, if you don't agree with me, you're dead.
Right. Right.
Anything that you stand for is dead.
Right.
That's why we're blowing up mosques. They blow up examples of history, you know, hundreds, 1,000 years old, 4,000 years old.
Right.
Things have been destroyed.
That's awful. Yep.
And it is historical imperialism.
Right.
And it's a dangerous thing.
Right.
And we go through this periodically.
Right. The name for it, of course, is ideology.
Mm-hmm.
When your theology becomes an ideology,
that's
a philosophy which is absolute in its truth, and there is nothing to compare with it, and anything that competes with it or criticizes it must be eliminated.
Yeah.
Marxism, radical Marxism, is an ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got people like Stalin and Lenin who are willing to murder and let millions and millions of people of their own citizens die because they didn't agree with the ideology.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened in Cambodia. Certainly in China, millions of people were allowed to simply starve and die because the ideology needed to be preserved. And so ideology is a scary thing.
It is. And we have it in many different areas of our life. There's the Christians, okay, remember there was a Christian movement back in the, 400s, called iconoclasm,
mm-hmm.
The iconoclast, where they just said, all right, we don't want to have any images.
Right.
And that's the icon, and clasm was destroy, and they would go around and destroy beautiful works of art,
right.
Beautiful statues, because that was wrong.
Right.
And we lost vast amounts of historical treasure and symbolism that at least, even if you didn't agree with it,
right.
You'd say it's beautiful.
Well, the reformers themselves were guilty of that. Yeah. The reformers themselves, when all the churches, of course, were Roman churches, Roman
yep.
Catholic churches, and when they became Protestant churches, in many cases, they simply took down the statues and whitewashed the walls. Fortunately, they used whitewash that could be later removed when they regained yeah. their sanity.
John, this has been a tremendous delight talking to you, and I wish we could do this again. We will do this again if you are willing to put up with this
Absolutely.
Again.
Absolutely.
We've been talking to John Buchanan, who is the former pastor of the Fourth Presbyterian Church and the editor and publisher of the Christian Century and resident part-time of southwestern Michigan. The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. And until then, remember our mantra: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.